As an emergency physician, I've seen firsthand what happens when people lose themselves in their work. That's why I built a coaching practice grounded in real data, not guesswork. When we work together, you'll start with a DISC assessment, which will generate a 40-page deep dive into your behavioral strengths, your motivators, and the workplace triggers that cost you the most. Then we bring in objective biometric data. We can use any number of wearable devices, including the Oura Ring, to understand how your sleep and recovery directly shape your capacity for joy and performance. This isn't a one-size-fits-all program. Every coaching engagement is customized to you because the work of following your heartline looks different for everyone. If you're a healthcare professional ready to reconnect with why you started, visit the link in the show notes or head over to AndreaAustinMD.com.
Hi, friends. I am so excited for you to hear today's episode with Dr. Rob Orman. When I think about people that have made a huge contribution to the field of emergency medicine, people that I felt in my ear during those difficult airways, and now increasingly more in my ear when I am navigating difficult moments in the emergency department, in leadership, in moments that I need a coach, that person in my ear frequently is Dr. Rob Orman. So it was a real honor to sit down with him for this conversation. And it was such a joy that this is a longer episode than normal. So I'm going to break it into two parts. This first part, we talk about some of his early career, and the conversation took an interesting turn into how he really became a mass casualty expert and how that parlayed into him becoming a technical advisor for the hit TV show, The Pitt. And I think it's such a cool conversation about how if you follow your passion and you're really true to what keeps you curious and excited and engaged in your professional arena, there will be dividends that you cannot anticipate. And so something that he did years ago ended up paving the way for him to be involved in the show, The Pitt. So it's a really cool story that I wasn't expecting. And I think you're just really going to enjoy that half of the episode. And we'll also get into what he's doing now. So enjoy part one. And thanks for being here. And as always, hit me up on Instagram or LinkedIn at AndreaAustinMD. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast, who you want to hear next. And this time is valuable. And it means a lot to me that you chose to listen and connect here, following your heartline and seeking ways to be that change maker that the healthcare system needs. And certainly, this episode gives us a lot more tools in our change-making toolbox.
Welcome to Heartline, Change-Making in Healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Andrea Austin, a board-certified emergency physician, physician development coach, and educator. After years on the front lines, I've learned that real change in healthcare starts within. Each episode invites you to explore the inner work that unlocks clarity and bold leadership. Because healing systems through change-making begins with following our heartlines.
I am so excited today. I have the only Dr. Rob Orman with me. He is a physician coach and former emergency physician. Although I'd argue you're always an emergency
physician. Always got it. It's in your blood.
It's a mindset. It's not a place. With 2 decades of clinical experience, he is the author of Supernormal, a field guide for the impossible job, which I'm holding a copy of. Ooh, doesn't that look nice right next to my book? And I actually gave a copy of this book to all of my faculty as a gift to starting the new academic year. So I love this book. And it covers how to recover from burnout, navigate conflict and behavioral challenges, and build careers worth staying in. And I needed this book a decade ago. I'm so thankful it's here. And it's great for whatever stage of your career you're in. My faculty actually spans, I think we have some maybe Gen Z faculty, very close to that. young millennials all the way to boomers. And I truly think this book will speak to all of them. More about you. He hosts Stimulus, a top-ranked medical podcast focused on resilience, mindset, and career design in medicine. It's a must listen. I love your podcast. He spent thousands of hours coaching physicians through the realities of modern medical practice. And he has a really interesting focus of his coaching right now, and I hope we get into that soon. He's also co-founded Guidewire Coaching for nearly a decade, hosted Essentials of Emergency Medicine, the world's largest single-track emergency medicine conference, which I don't know if I ever told you this. I actually attended that conference the month I got home from deployment, and I was scared to go back and see patients, like hospital versus like a war zone, and I hadn't seen very many peds. And that conference was like the little shot I needed to like get back in the arena. And he serves as the technical advisor on the Emmy-winning HBO series, The Pitt, the man, the legend, Dr. Robert.
Thank you. You know, it was so cool to see our books right now. When you're holding them up there, you've got the poster of yours and holding mine, because I feel like our books are kind of siblings. They each have our vibe and our experience. I mean, both of our books are super experiential. And I will say this to your listeners. My book would not have happened without you, because when it was in the nascent stages and I was still writing it, you and I spoke and you said, you need to do this. You need to talk to this person. You have this editor. I mean, you send me your developmental editor. You do this. This is how you upload it. And this is how you want to think about writing it. And then we just had this, I don't know, it was probably an hour long conversation. And you mentored me on how to write a book, because it turns out, I thought there's not domain transfer from being a doctor or coaching to learning the nuances of this. So my gratitude for you and writing this book is endless, and seeing them together they do sit together actually on my bookshelf, because I've got yours right back here. So anyway, I wanted to share that at the outset of this, that it's such synergy that we've got going on.
You know, I haven't shared this with any of the listeners. I am actually coaching physicians that want to write books, and I would be open to any healthcare professional, because one of the things, and maybe I told you we're going to get off script very quickly. One of my theories on how we fix healthcare is actually something that you're already doing. You're involved with the Pitt. And so I am such a believer in my brand that I think you've seen this. I have this tattoo, my book cover. And while I was getting my tattoo done, the tattoo artist said, "Yo, doc, the Pitt, that's pretty heavy. Is that what it's really like?" And it was just this breakthrough moment that average people are starting to see more of our world. And so the point of that story is I feel very, very driven to support more of our healthcare professionals to share their stories. And then I hope more of their stories gets turned into other art, gets turned into Netflix shows, and starts to really permeate. Because when you look at any movement, and we need a movement right now to change healthcare, art has always been a huge symbol, a huge vehicle for transformational change. So we just went to the Pitt. I don't know if you want to share any reflections or... See, I went off script right away. I'm sorry.
I think about this a lot because, you know, you and I both put on podcasts, and rarely will you listen to a podcast 100 times, but you will listen to a song 100 times, or you will read a favorite poem 100 times, and it just activates a different part of your brain. I don't even know what part of the brain it is, but you feel that sense of connection, maybe even a little dopamine release. And yeah, the Pitt was interesting. I'm not a continued technical advisor on it. It was the mass casualty episodes. And when I was hosting emergency medicine, the Las Vegas mass shooting happened. And I went down there with my producer, Tom Wolfson, and our cameraman, Ben Bonner, and we got a hotel room and made it into a recording studio. And we recorded for 3 days many of the folks who were there when it happened, including the ED doc, who all he thought about was how he was going to do this. And he happened to be on duty when it happened. And then all of the other docs and the trauma surgeons and nurses and, you know, the pediatric doc who drove in as fast as he could. You know, what happened? How did they describe the story? And it was just days and days of learning about that and getting the detail and the nuance. And hey, what would you want to do different? And what would you say? And what did you say? And what happened when you lost suction? And then, you know, people are shot in the neck. And how are you intubating them? And all of these little things. And the producer of the pit, Joe Sachs, is also an ED doc. And we had made like a little documentary about that for the conference. And it was 15 minutes versus the 9 hours we had. So we had all of this recording and all of this experience talking with these folks. And they said, can we have that video? I said, yeah. I mean, it's Hollywood. So there's like contracts and all sorts of things. And it was months and months. And it takes a long time to do all those things. But we gave them all of that video. And then they used that to inform the mass casualty episodes of that. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, the things they're saying and the things they're doing are straight from that footage that no one else has seen except the three of us who made it. Most hospitals don't have this, but one of the trauma surgeons said, we asked him, actually asked him a couple of questions. There was this one NPR question that I got from this book. It's called Out on the Wire. It's one of the This American Life producers. And she said, you know, one of the questions I like to ask is, what did you think this would be like? And then what was it really like? And I asked that to all the folks, because you think you know what a mass casualty would be like. Yep. And this trauma surgeon said, what was it like? It was awesome, because I trained my entire professional career to be able to do this, and I freaking did it. And then, I mean, that guy was cool. And so I said, what would you want to be different? He says, I want pallets for mass casualty. I want a pallet brought in of all the stuff, of all my chest tubes and all my endotracheal tubes and all my laryngoscopes, all that stuff, mass casualty pallet. And they had that on the show. They had the mass casualty pallet that they wheeled.
I remember that.
Oh, and my wife and I are sitting there watching it like, oh my God, this is all the stuff from that footage. And so that was the pit thing. And the thing that I love about that show is that, yeah, I mean, there's one aspect of it that, wow, all of that pathology, that's basically a career in one television series of the things you'll see, is it does show the nuance of what it's like in the ED. I mean, there's without what it feels like to have your cortisol out of whack after four night shifts in a row, because you really can't replicate that. But, oh, this is what these folks experience. And it's amazing what they do. It's amazing what they know. And it turns out that they are people too. Whoa, they are people too. And I think that aspect of it, like Dr. Robbie in this season, you know, he's burnt and he's acting like a jerk and he's not supportive. And then everyone else's kind of personal lives without it being overly dramatic. It's like, wow, when I go in and I talk to someone and I to them in a certain way, I'm imperious or I'm impatient, it turns out that they're just human beings trying to do the best they can. And I wonder if that aspect of it is one of the things that is connecting with people.
Oh my gosh, we could spend the whole episode on the pit, but there's so many things I want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
And hats off for your work on the pit and the contribution you made with the mass casualty and having the vision that you had when that event was unfolding to document it. And what a service that was to the profession of medicine to have that documented. And I'm just going to put it out into the universe. I hope it comes back another way, because, you know, there should be a documentary made about the impact of these mass shootings on our communities of trauma surgery and nursing and emergency medicine. I got to listen to one emergency doctor that was on that night. She was at the community hospital that was not the level one trauma center. And you probably know this detail, but because of a communication mishap, a bunch of patients, instead of the level one, they went to the other level two, or it wasn't the big academic one with arguably more resources. So there's just so many stories from these events. And again, I'm putting it out there. We need more of us connecting with artists, producers, and getting these stories out there to create the narratives that are going to move the politicians and citizens to make the changes we need.
I'd love to build on that a little bit. So this mass casualty thing, that for me was built out of fear, because I was involved in one mass casualty, and it's not really fun actually to do it. From the time I was a resident, so I was at Denver General Hospital when Columbine happened, and I was actually off service, but was happening in the ED, and I was actually in the dental clinic doing a dental rotation when it was happening. So I was in Columbine and said, wow, I do not feel prepared for this. So I did the same thing that we did for Vegas with Columbine. And I did that for the Denver General residency and the paramedics, and we interviewed all the people and we broke down what happened. And then I did it for this, and I did it with an individual with when the port exploded in Lebanon. And I did it for a bunch of other mass casualties. And this was kind of the thing that I was always afraid. And I was asking these questions selfishly for me, because I'm thinking, how did you do this? How did you mentally do this? How did you recover? What were the logistics of it? And I didn't really talk about this on the educational platforms I have, but that really drove all of my medical education. When I was running MRAP and ERCAST and Essentials, it was, what makes me nervous on a shift? What do I not know? And that just kind of became the driver for how the education went.
Before we get into today's episode, I want to share something that I think a lot of you need to hear about. Heart of Medicine 2026 is an international gathering of compassionate leaders in medicine. Doctors, nurses, allied health clinicians, coaches, healthcare leaders, all coming together July 29 through 31 at Voyagers Ayers Rock Resort in Central Australia. And yes, it's in Uluru, the spiritual heart of Australia. Because this event is intentional about where it places you, not just what it teaches you, you'll learn from world-class faculty about heart-centered care, compassionate leadership, and what it actually looks like to build a longer, more fulfilling career in medicine. You'll leave with the skills, community, and honestly, your spirit a little bit more intact. This is not a typical CME box check. This is the kind of gathering that reminds you medicine is still worth fighting for. I'll be there, and I'd love to see you there. Registration is limited because the resort is remote and intimate. So don't sit on this one. Link is in the show notes.
It's awesome. So I'm going to go back to the first question. And I feel like it's going to tie in to some of the things we've talked about. What's one personal belief or experience that's radically reshaped how you show up as a change maker in healthcare?
I'm going to just tell you the first thing that popped in my head. I did not know that question was coming. So Mizuho Morrison, who is a dear friend, and we have worked together for a decade and a half on various things, she said something to me that changed my life and completely changed my belief. I grew up in a smallish town in Colorado and is somewhat insulated from the rest of the world. And I knew people had political beliefs that were different than me and maybe spiritual beliefs and whatever. But I kind of had this sense. I mean, this is many years ago. I got this, I don't know, drilled into me. I had this sense that everybody thought like I thought. I kind of had the same thought process of how they would work through problems or how they might even view the world, the mindset or the lens with which they view the world. And remember, somebody had written into MRAP when I was running that. And I don't even understand where they're coming from. You know, why would they see this? And Mizuho said, not everybody in the world thinks like you, dude. And was this an offhand comment, you know, from one friend to another, that only a friend can really give that kind of honesty? I thought, that is fundamentally true. And I think that even about patients, you know, that, oh, you're probably processing this logically like I am. I mean, I don't know why I thought that. But in that moment, it was a total reset to really start to focus on having cognitive empathy for other people, not affective empathy, you know, which is something you feel or you don't feel, but we can get into that. But, oh, let me see, do I actually understand? Can I fully understand where you're coming from? And I heard there was this commencement address from a student at Harvard, and he had this one line in there about listening. And he said, listen like you might be wrong. And I thought, oh, that, yes. And I will say that that is something that I need to focus on continually, because I think I just had that natural predilection to think, oh, you process and you think, and maybe even have a similar viewpoint than me, it, you know, might come to a different conclusion. So I don't know, did that address the question or did I answer a different question?
I love it. And it's really what my research on changemakers has shown. One of the themes that emerged was successful changemakers listen for dissent. That's what you're describing. Most of us listen for agreement because we walk around, most of us are fairly egotistical, especially doctors. And so we like it when people agree with us. And anytime somebody's disagreeing with you, if you're a feeling person, most of us are going to experience at least a flash of discomfort. So I guess the follow-up question to that is, how did you learn to navigate it? It's kind of, this is the quest of my life. You know, the quote that's attributed to Viktor Frankl is, between stimulus and response is the space or the pause, and that is where all your freedom begins. How do you create the pause?
Okay, we're talking about focus of coaching before this. This is definitely the core of the tools that I teach in coaching. So, you know, my book, you described what it's about. And I wrote that because, oh, these tools, these stories, these things and keep coming up in one-on-one coaching, and this could easily be a book. And alas, it was a book that actually I just have my clients read it. I said, look, read this. The tools are in there and we'll work on it. And really what I want is someone to read it and say, oh, I don't really need a coach. I got it. This is just the thing that I needed. But the kind of coaching that I do, I primarily do behavioral coaching. And so that is doctors who have some kind of behavior which is discordant with, say, the culture of their institution, or they're on a performance improvement plan or an FPPE. These are all these things that say, hey, this behavior needs to change in this period of time. And then I work with them. And they have this habit of this behavior. And there is no space between stimulus and response. There is no space. It's just reactive. I don't know how to stop this thing. I don't even know when I'm doing it. Perfect. That is a great place to start. And the first part, I mean, and this is the gift that Mizuho gave me, is the first part is awareness, is being aware of when it's happening. And I can get into the nitty-gritty detail of how that goes, but really it's, okay, what is the thing you're doing? What's going on in your mind? What's the usual situation? And I want you to pay attention to when this is happening over the next 2 weeks. And what's the situation? What did you do? How did you feel? What did you say? How did it go? Keep a little log. Every time it happens, write it down, not in the middle of a recess. You know, you can do reflective processing after the patient's been intubated. And it's just having them take a step outside of themselves and look. It's a little bit of detachment, not in a dissociative way, but let me examine, like going back to Aristotle, let me examine what's going on with me in my life and start to build awareness of what's happening. And building awareness alone is shocking when you do it, because you just, wow, I wasn't aware of all the times this was happening. And even these little eruptions, there are many other steps in there. But that is the entryway of, oh, I'm thinking this thing, I'm doing this thing, or this behavior is about to come out, and oh, I'm fighting against it. We work on the fighting against it later. Awareness is not 90% of the work, but it gets you 90% of the way there, because it creates a little pause. And let me share a story about a client. I thought, oh, this is the greatest success. So I had this client who was actually in leadership at a hospital and was on a performance improvement plan. And we worked hard on all of this stuff. And then after awareness, we have, you know, many other tools. And then how are you going to respond? And we can talk about what those tools look like. But we got to a point where in these situations, they had 5 or 6 tools to work with of, okay, here are things that I can do differently than how I used to react when I wasn't even aware I was reacting that way. And so came to a coaching session and said, oh, you know, I think I didn't do too well in the situation. Is, you know, someone came up and they said this thing to me and I felt that my reactivity bubbling up. I felt it. I felt the urge to do the thing that got me in trouble. And then I thought about, okay, what tool do I need to apply here? What tool should I apply this tool? Should I apply that tool? What's going to work best here? What's going to happen? How will this person best respond? I said, you know, and then I don't know if the tool that I then used was the best tool. I said, wait a second, let's back up a little bit. You just did the thing. I don't care what tool you use. I don't care. It matters. You paused. You created space. You slowed things down. Slow it down. That was it. When you're thinking about that, you are in the space now, just getting back to that Frankl thing, which I probably Stephen Covey wrote. I don't know. I mean, who knows who really wrote that? It's so funny about the attribution of that quote, but it's now you have choice. Like, that's the whole thing about that quote is in that space lives choice. When you are reactive, you don't have choice. And how you build choice is by first having awareness.
Before we started recording, you mentioned that you have some retreats that you facilitate. And are you of the opinion that if you don't meditate, the road to creating that pause is much more difficult? Like, do you think meditation is a necessity, or have you noticed that pattern with clients?
I would love it if all of my clients meditated, but I don't force that in sessions or in engagements. So it definitely helps because it builds awareness, but it is not at all a prerequisite for this. And that's almost two different tools that they are building. It's kind of in the moment awareness, kind of point of care awareness versus the send out lab. It's just meditation, you know? So when a client wants to learn more about meditation, oh, we will definitely do that. And I mean, some of that is in my book as well, but it's not a prerequisite because awareness can happen in the instant. And even taking that moment to reflect on what am I doing right now? What's my state of mind? Just that alone, that is a completely different world than not thinking about it. Meditation is training. There's many different outcomes for meditation, many things it does, many different schools. But if we're talking about mindfulness meditation, so the word mindfulness in the original Pali means remembering. That's what really mindfulness is, remembering of, oh, I remember that I'm here in the present moment. I'm not time traveling forward. I'm not traveling backwards, not re-legislating insults, which have happened over time. So I will lightly recommend an app, say, hey, check out this app. I think it might help. And, you know, a couple of these meditations might do that. But I would say over the years, maybe 20% of my clients have a meditation practice or have developed a meditation practice. We focus on it a lot in our retreat to introduce that. And it's funny, when someone comes into one of our retreats and has never meditated, they think, oh, that was kind of hard with all that meditation. So for the next one, it's happened in February of 2026, we are going to be doing some pre-work to help them train for meditation.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit more about how you got into coaching. And I still think that there's a bit of a stigma around coaching and a feeling that sometimes coaching, it's woo-woo. I think it would help if people, knowing that you have this long history of being one of the educators in our specialty and practicing evidence-based medicine, how did you end up in coaching?
So I was practicing community emergency medicine for 20 years. And in the second 10 of those, I was heavily involved in medical education, as you say, and that became my primary job. And I got down to working about 3 shifts a month. And it turned out that was not enough to stay sharp. And I started getting skill decay. And there was one event where I thought, wow, you know, I need to either go back to full-time or I'll just do medical education full-time, which is what I did. And then I'm doing medical education full-time, but I'm not practicing medicine. I did not feel that drive. And I was talking before about, wow, it's really that kind of that anxiety and that fear that drives it. Or also the knowledge. I remember I was interviewing somebody about a new intubation technique, and I listened back to it. I thought, I didn't have those in the moment questions of what, because I really didn't have myself there, and I hadn't just intubated a couple patients in the past month. I think that this era of my career is coming to a close and I need to do something different. And it was really a hard thing because when we do medicine and we're doctors, the whole path is laid out ahead of us. It's not an easy path, but it's college, med school, residency, attendinghood. And when you've got to figure it out on your own, it is not easy. And you and I have both worked with many docs trying to figure it out on their own when they want to change it. It's not easy. So it took about 6 months of soul searching to what I was going to do. And I had three career paths. I thought actually about getting a master's in education and being a high school science teacher, because that is just something that I had always thought I want to do. But I thought, do I actually want to be involved in the education system and deal with students who are not really interested in the class? Actually, no, I just want to teach science. So I didn't want that. Then it was down to two. I was either going to get a master's in counseling and work only with physicians, or become a coach and work only with physicians. And that is because in the ED, the patients were great. I loved working with the other docs. And I see that physicians are so valuable, but don't always see that themselves as human beings and to society. And I just felt so connected to the physician community, and that working with them and helping them navigate struggles, the only way that I can describe it is it was a calling. It was just kind of, yes, that's it. That's right. That's the thing that I want to do with my life. And what do I want this to look like? We can get into how the details went, but I ended up with coaching. And I thought, this is who I needed when I was a young doc, burnt and struggling. I needed someone like me, that sounds weird, who has this training. And you think about, I didn't know what the training was going to be like. And I was at the Center for Executive Coaching. And so the people that I was working with, you know, one guy had been the CEO of Viacom, and another person was the head of HR for, like, I don't know, some the biggest blah, 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 blah company. So these were all executives doing executive coaching. And I'm telling you, is there a little woo? I guess if you're doing reflection on how you're acting, how you're thinking, what's your mindset? Okay. But the evidence would say that when you are able to change those things, you change not only your experience, but you change outcomes, you change your physiology with that. So I wouldn't say that's exactly woo. And I also did training in something called positive intelligence, which informs a lot of the behavioral coaching that I do. So I was like, I learned about behavioral coaching in the primary thing. I need more. I need to go deeper into this. So the thing that truly drives me, I think, is my experience throughout my career of struggling and working with docs who are struggling and being in a position of having a big platform of receiving correspondence from docs who are struggling. I think, well, that is something that I want to help with. And I try to do that on a large scale with reach, with podcasts, with newsletter, with courses and all that. And I love doing it on a small scale, that one on one, and thinking about, how did you get into this? Why this thing? I am a serial processor, sister. I'm a serial processor. One thing at a time. Oh, I nail it in the resus bay. Oh, champion. 10 patients at once, got a 50 tasks and a never ending list that is increasing. I was easily overwhelmed in the ED. And so I thought, the next thing I do, I want it to be serial processing, which is why I love working one-on-one. That's my happy place. And then working on one-on-one to help transform a physician's life and career, there's no better feeling like that. When I do that, I will say that the joy I get in that is far greater than any medical save I ever had.
Yeah. Before we started recording, we talked about in a client is really struggling, and you work with some clients, you mentioned earlier, that if they don't improve, they may lose their job. It's high stakes. And so I said it was like the resuscitation of the coaching world. Yeah. It's not like, oh, what do I want to do with my life? Which is a huge existential question that coaching is fantastic for. But, you know, whether I'm going to be able to keep seeing patients and have an income, that's high stakes. And so I think it's a natural progression. But I also want to highlight for the listeners, Dr. Rob Orman, who was the voice that we listen to so often as the expert or the person that would lead us to the expert to learn a procedure or how to handle all the chaos and stress of a mass casualty or working in the emergency department, is saying that he struggled a lot of his career and didn't feel like it was a great fit, a lot of the time. And I just want listeners to hear that it's okay. Because I do think we hold up people that look at this person, you know, they're on MRAP or they work at this academic institution or they do this. And we think that they've got it all together. But I'm friends with enough people at this point to say, I don't know. Yeah, we have a podcast, but we're just still trying to get through. I have a few more tools in my toolbox, but this is a hard job. I so loved that conversation with Dr. Orman. I hope that you'll tune in next week and we'll be talking about what's changed in medicine. And even though, spoiler alert, we both think it's gotten harder, we talk about what's giving us hope and what role we think coaching plays in the future of medicine. I am also really excited for next week's episode when Dr. Orman will read a passage from his book. And the passage he reads is so juicy. It is one of the best pearls that honestly would fix both pretty much every professional and personal problem you can think about. So I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to leave you on the edge of your seat and come back here next week. Until then, make sure you're following your heartline.
Thanks for listening to Heartline, Changemaking in Healthcare. If you're ready to deepen your own inner work or want to bring these conversations into your organization, visit AndreaAustinMD.com. You'll find resources and ways to connect with me for coaching, speaking, or consulting. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a 5-star review, and share this episode with a friend or colleague. Until next time, keep following your heartline.
This podcast represents the views of the host and guests. It does not represent the views of any entity we work for or with. It is also for informational use only and does not replace any professional advice, including medical or psychological. If you are interested in unlocking your true potential, reach out to me. If you're an organization interested in supporting the well-being of your people, I'd love to connect on innovative solutions. Schedule a strategy session at AndreaAustinMD.com.